Sure. I've got time this afternoon if you want to stop by. What's good for you? Not your office, I said. He was silent briefly. Okay. Then where? What about the shack at Ludlow Beach? Great. We can have lunch. My treat. See you there in 20 minutes. I hadn't called him looking for a lunch date, but the minute he mentioned it, I realized I was starving, so why not? I'd chosen the location because it was off the beaten path. A tourist spot as opposed to a restaurant frequented by local residents. The place was bound to be somebody's favorite, but it wasn't popular with cops. The shack was right on the beach, sheltered from the view of passing cars by a large parking lot. Blue and white striped awnings shaded the deck where the tables were set out. Once upon a time, I'd come close to being killed in the big trash bin outside. This counts as nostalgia for someone like me. I found a table for two in the corner on the far side and sat facing the entrance. When Cheney appeared, I lifted my hand to attract his attention. He threaded his way between the tables, and when he reached me, he gave me the obligatory buss on the cheek before he pulled out a chair and sat down. He was in chinos, a white dress shirt, and a suede silk sport coat the color of wild brown bunnies. Cheney came from money, and while he'd declined to go into his father's banking business, a trust fund allowed him to dress with impeccable taste. He favored earth tones, colors that reminded me of nature's softer side, in sensual fabrics I wanted to reach out and touch. He also smelled better than almost any man I've known. Some combination of soap, shampoo, aftershave, and body chemistry. There were moments I remembered from our short-lived affair, and I had to resist the temptation to sexualize my contact with him. We chatted, and then ordered, and then ate. As hungry as I'd been, I scarcely paid attention to the meal. I was anxious, and I could feel myself stalling, not wanting to launch into my spiel. I don't know if I was afraid he wouldn't take me seriously, or that he'd judge the facts too thin to act upon. Cheney finally pushed the point. What's on your mind? I reached into my shoulder bag, took out my report, and placed it face down on the table. I've put together some information that should probably go to Lynn, but I can't bring myself to deal with him. You know how he feels about me after what happened to Mickey. He'd dismiss anything I said, but he might pay attention if it came from you.
Give me the gist.
Organized retail theft. I wouldn't have known anything about it if it hadn't been for Audrey's death. I'd been engrossed in the subject for days, and I laid it out for him in an orderly progression. I watched his expression alter as I worked my way through events from the beginning to the current moment. Cheney's a smart guy, so I knew I didn't have to spell out the broader picture when I was already providing the specifics. At the end of my summary, he held out his hand for the report. I gave it to him and watched him leaf through the pages. Once or twice he looked at me in sharp surprise, which, I confess, I took as a compliment. When he finished reading, he said, "How'd you come up with the connection to the consignment shop?" I was chatting with someone about fencing operations. The name came out of our conversation. I told him about the boxes I'd picked up and the shipping labels. He was momentarily quiet and not making eye contact, which didn't bode well. He seemed to be filtering the information through a framework different from mine. "What's the matter?" I asked.
"Sorry. You caught me by surprise. I didn't realize what you were up to."
What I was up to?
"I didn't know you were so interested in Audrey Vance."
"I don't know why not. I told you Marvin Stryker hired me to look into her past. That's what I was asking about the day I ran into you and Len having lunch. What's going on?"
"Nothing you could have known about."
"What, like there's already an investigation underway?"
"All I can tell you is you're treading on sensitive ground, and I suggest you back off."
"Well, if it's any comfort to you, I've come to a dead end," I said. "If I knew what to do at this point, I wouldn't be here. This is your bailiwick, not mine."
"True. and I appreciate what you've accomplished. Now promise me you'll let it drop. I said, so I must be on track or you wouldn't be clamming up. This is not your concern. I don't mean to be hard-nosed, but I know how you operate. You get on the scent of something and it's hard to pull you off. I'm not faulting you on that score or any other. Imagine my relief, I said. He looked down at the report. You have copies or is this it? Why do you ask? Because I might need to confiscate the material for a period of time. I don't want the information floating around. You're kidding. The look he gave me was utterly without mirth, so I thought it best to abandon my jocular tone. I leaned toward him and lowered my voice. Jesus, Cheney, if I was stepping in a pile of shit, why didn't you say so at the time? My fault entirely. I should have warned you. Of what? Just let it go, okay? I know you mean well. I don't understand what's at stake. I don't want to make trouble. You know me better than that, so what's the deal? You're putting a CI in jeopardy. How so? I don't know anything about a confidential informant. This is all news to me. He studied me briefly. I'll tell you this if you swear you won't breathe a word of it to anyone. I swear. The retail theft ring is only one part of the equation. Pretty's under investigation as well. The informant's working both sides of the street. Len thinks he's milking the guy for information, but the CI is reporting back to us and feeding him lines while we build our case. His testimony will be critical. Pretty's a slippery customer, and all these years, no one's been able to nail him. Oh, I hear you, I said. I'd love nothing better than to see him brought down. Leave that to us. Len's got cop friends who'd do anything for him. We know some of them, but not all. So walk a wide path around him. You can trust me, but don't talk to anyone else. He took out his wallet and extracted a 20 and a 10 and put it under his plate. Lunch didn't cost that much, I said. I like to leave a good tip. So here's one. Bury the topic until I tell you it's okay. I'll send someone around to pick up any other copies of this you have on hand. He folded the report and slid it into the inside pocket of his sport coat. Driving back to the office, I deconstructed the conversation, separating the elements for review. It was obvious the police department was running an investigation that paralleled mine, the two intersecting at more than one point. I wasn't sure where they were in the process, but they had to be focused on the same operation I'd been looking at, though doubtless at a more sophisticated and comprehensive level. There was probably a task force in place, several agencies pooling their resources as they gathered intelligence. Cheney's revelation both thrilled and troubled me. I didn't expect him to bear all. These days, the legal system is so finely calibrated that a breach in security or a violation of procedure can spell disaster. As a rule, I keep my nose out of police business, though it's not always easy. I do tend to fixate on a problem and worry it to death. Here, what I loved more than snooping was the idea of Len Pretty being exposed for what he was. Cheney's warning had come too late to steer me off the subject of retail theft, but I intended to heed his caution about Len. What disturbed me was knowing just enough to feel I might be vulnerable. As I turned onto my block, I noticed a dark green Chevrolet parked in my usual place at the curb. I didn't think much about it since parking is at such a premium. It's first come, first served, and I'm often forced to hunt for the next available spot. I found a length of curb where my front bumper encroached on a private driveway, but only by 3 feet. At the end of the day, if I was lucky, I'd escape without a ticket. Coming up the walk, I stopped short at the front steps, alerted by the fact that the door was open when I knew I'd locked up when I left. I took 4 paces to the side and peered in the window, where I could see Len Pretty doing a finger walk through my files. I tried to think how I'd behave with him if Cheney hadn't warned me. Len already knew there was no love lost between us. But beyond our mutual dislike, I'd never had reason to be afraid of him. Now I was. I went into the outer office, and when I appeared in the doorway, he didn't even seem embarrassed at being caught in the act. I said, "You mind if I ask what you're doing?" He turned. "Sorry. You weren't here when I arrived, so I let myself in. Is that a problem?" He had tossed any number of file folders on the floor, not because it was necessary, but to illustrate his contempt. "That depends on what you want." I moved toward my desk, keeping as much distance between the two of us as I could muster. Glancing down, I could see he'd made a point of leaving my desk drawers ajar, so I'd know he'd been through them as well. I made no comment. He said, "Relax. This is nothing official. I thought it was time for us to chat." He removed a file folder and slid the drawer shut. He tossed the folder on the desk and then settled in my swivel chair, tilted back, propping his feet against the edge. He reached for the folder and pulled out a single sheet of paper, the photocopy of Marvin's check. Cleverly, I'd filed a written report on Audrey elsewhere, so he had no way to determine what I knew. He shook his head in disapproval. "Looks like you haven't come up with anything on Audrey Vance, which surprises me. I thought you were a crack investigator and you got bupkis. You take Marvin's money, the least you could do is give him something in return." Rapidly, I scrolled through the possible responses, trying to figure out how best to protect myself. "I haven't started on it yet. I have a case that took precedence," I said. The lie slipped out so easily I didn't think he caught the hesitation before I answered him. "Then you ought to give him his money back." "Good plan. I'll have to chat with him and see if he feels the same." "He does. He's no longer in the market for your services." "Thanks for the heads up," I said. The game playing annoyed me, but it was better for him to think he had the upper hand. I didn't want to antagonize him. No sass, no wisecracks. "If you tell me why you're here, maybe I can help." "I'm in no hurry." "How about yourself? You have pressing business to conduct?" He peered closely at my empty calendar. "It doesn't look like it." He tossed Audrey's file on the desk and got up. He put his hands in his trouser pockets and looked out the window at the street. By turning his back, he was showing me how sure he was of himself. He was a big man, and seeing him in silhouette, I was unnerved by his bulk. Like many middle-aged men, he'd gained weight, 25 to 30 pounds by the look of him. In his case, most of it was muscle mass. He and Mickey had lifted weights together in the early days, a routine he'd apparently kept up. He seemed indifferent to any action I might take, but I knew better. He turned around and looked at me, leaning a hip on the windowsill. "We have a mutual friend who came to see you earlier. I've been out. Before you left for lunch." He had to be referring to Pinky or Earl Dean, and I was nominating Pinky. In a flash, I knew he was after the photographs. As quickly as it occurred to me, I suppressed the thought, cautious he'd pick up on my mental process. Many sociopaths, like Len, seem able to read minds, a skill that doubtless results from the inbuilt paranoia that motivates so much of what they do. I said, "I'm not sure who you mean." "Your pal, Pierpont." "Pierpont?" The name meant nothing. I shook my head. "Pinky. His real name is Pierpont?" "That's what his jacket says. He has a long criminal history, as I'm sure you're aware." "I know he's been in jail. Are you looking for him?" "Not him. A manila envelope. I believe he left it with you." Len was either featured in one set of photographs or protecting the person who was. If the photos were of Len, I couldn't imagine how he'd been compromised. Pinky viewed the pictures as his trump card. So what was that about? I said, "You've got it wrong. He asked me to hang on to the envelope, and I refused. He smiled.
Good try, but I don't think so.
It's true. He wouldn't tell me what was in the envelope, so I said I couldn't help. He took it with him when he left.
Not so. He walked out empty-handed. I was watching.
What had Pinky done? I remembered the brief lag time between his leaving my inner office and his appearance on the street. The only thing I could think of was that he'd hidden the envelope under his shirt or down the front of his pants. I was the one who'd suggested he might be under surveillance, so I'd unwittingly engineered my current difficulty, which was to persuade Len the envelope wasn't in my possession. I put my hands in the air as though at gunpoint. I don't have it. Honest. You've already searched my file cabinets and the desk drawers, so you know it's not there. Check my shoulder bag if you want. I set my bag on the desk. He didn't want to appear too interested, so he took his time, casually pawing through the miscellany. Wallet, makeup bag, a few over-the-counter meds, keys, spiral-bound notebook, which he stopped and leafed through before tossing it aside. I was fearful he'd spot the index cards and confiscate the lot of them, but he was focused on the image of an 8x10 envelope and disregarded anything that didn't match that description. I could feel the tension seep into my bones. I was reacting to Len the way I'd react to a street thug or a belligerent drunk, someone capable of violence if provoked. I didn't believe he'd attack me because an assault would leave him vulnerable to charges. There were no wants and warrants out against me, and he had no way to justify getting physical.
"Where's the safe?"
he asked. I pointed at the floor to one side of the room. My safe was concealed under a section of my bubblegum pink wall-to-wall carpeting. He gestured impatiently, indicating I was to hop to, and I complied. I knew there was no manila envelope, so what was it to me? He crossed the room and stood over me while I pulled the carpet back and exposed the safe to view. I hated his knowing where it was, but it was better to appear cooperative. I got down on one knee and dialed in the combination. When the door swung open, he was forced to assume the same kneeling posture so he could empty the contents. I glanced at the door, realizing if I intended to bolt, this would be the time to do it. I kept the impulse in check, believing it was wiser to let the situation play out. The safe held nothing of interest, insurance policies, bank information, and the modest amount of cash I kept on hand. That's when I noticed he'd ripped the phone cord out of the wall and smashed the housing until it cracked in half. There was something about the savagery that scared me senseless. Too late, I realized I'd adopted the mindset of a kidnapped victim, thinking everything would be all right as long as I did as I was told. This notion was foolish on the face of it. It's always better to scream, run, or fight back. No one knew he was here. My bungalow is the only occupied structure on this side of the street. If he decided I was holding out on him, whether it was true or not, he could handcuff me, throw me in the trunk of his car, and pound the shit out of me in private until I gave him what he wanted. The fact that I didn't have the photographs wasn't relevant and would only net me more punishment. He was still pulling papers out of my safe when I made a break for the outside door. The problem was I'd been standing stiffly at attention, and I couldn't move fast enough. Even as I took the first two steps, I felt like I was weighted in place. He was on me before I'd gone 6 feet. I couldn't believe a man his size could act so quickly. He grabbed me by the shirt and hauled me backward off my feet, hooking an arm around my neck before I could marshal a defense. I knew the chokehold from my days as a rookie. This was called a lateral vascular neck restraint, or blood choke, with the crook of his elbow over the midpoint of my neck. All he had to do was increase the pressure, using his free hand for leverage. If I tried to turn around, it would only escalate the force of the hold. The pressure on my carotid arteries and jugular veins would result in hypoxia that would render me unconscious in seconds. Most police departments prohibit the use of the carotid hold unless an officer is threatened with death or serious injury. Len Priddy was from the old school, coming up through the ranks while the blood choke was still considered fair play. He was a full head taller and weighed a good 100 pounds more than I did. I couldn't make a sound. I clung to his arm, holding on with both hands as though I might actually ease his grip when I knew the effort would be futile. The pain was excruciating, and I was starved for oxygen. Len had his mouth up against my ear, his voice low. I know how to finish you off without leaving a mark on you. Complain about me, and I'll hurt you so bad it'll put you out of commission for the rest of your life. I'm coming down on you hard for your own damn good. Audrey Vance is none of your business. You get that? Anything you hear about, you keep shut. Whatever you see, you'd best look the other way. I find out you have those photographs, I will come back and kill you. Make no mistake about it. If you tell anyone else about this, the same penalty applies. Is that clear? I couldn't even nod. Next thing I knew, he shoved me to the floor and backed off, breathing hard himself. I was down on my hands and knees, sucking air into my lungs. I put a hand against my throat, where the sensation of compression and restriction was still vivid. I leaned my forehead on the carpet and put my arms over my head, gasping for breath. I knew he was standing over me. I thought he'd punch me or kick me, but he probably didn't dare risk bruising me or cracking my ribs. Dimly, I was aware of his walking away. I heard the outer office door open and shut. I crawled after him and locked the door in his wake. It wasn't until I heard his car start and pull away that I started to shake. Chapter 25. I rolled over on my back and lay on the floor until my heartbeat had slowed and the blood no longer pounded in my ears. I sat up, doing a canvas of my physical and emotional state. Swallowing was painful, and my confidence was shaken. Beyond that, I wasn't injured, but I was badly frightened. Now that the immediate threat had passed, I needed to pull myself together. I turned and stared at my office floor, which was littered with the papers Len had pulled from the safe. File folders and reports had been dumped from the file cabinets and lay scattered about. I wanted nothing more than to spend the next few minutes cleaning up the mess. Getting to my feet first would be a big help. My emotions were all over the place, and tidying my surroundings was the way I soothed myself in times of stress. For the moment, I'd have to forego indulging my inner Cinderella, because Pinky had priority. I didn't believe Len would kill me unless he could be sure the deed wouldn't be traced back to him. Pinky was the obvious target. He was a low-level criminal with prison associates who probably already represented a risk to his health and safety. If he died, no one would think much about it. Why he imagined he could outwit someone like Len was a mystery. I used a guest chair to pull myself upright and went into the bathroom where I stretched the rim of my turtleneck so I could examine my poor, abused flesh. Len was right when he boasted he hadn't left a mark. I picked up my broken telephone and tossed the hull into the trash. Fortunately, I still had the previous instrument I'd owned. I went into the kitchenette and opened and closed closet doors until I found it. It was an old black rotary phone, powdered with dust. I wiped it down with a towel and took it back to the office, where I plugged it into the old jack. I picked up the handset, reassured by the dial tone. I needed to contact Pinky and tell him what was going on. I was acutely aware of Len's warning to keep away from matters related to Audrey Vance, but Pinky and the photographs were another matter, weren't they? I knew that if Len caught up with Pinky, he was dead meat.
I had to make sure I got to him first. I wondered if Pinky had any idea the jeopardy he was in. He'd talked about using the photographs to get out of a jam, but trying to outsmart Len was trouble of a greater magnitude. I sat down at my desk and checked my address book for Pinky's phone number. I seldom had occasion to call him, and for all I knew, the contact number I had was long out of date. I put the end of my index finger in the first hole in which the number 9 appeared. I moved the dial to the right as far as the finger set and released it, thinking how odd it was to have to wait until the metal circle with the little holes in it rotated all the way back before hooking my finger into the next number in the sequence. Seemed to take forever. Lo and behold, the line rang. I listened, counting. At 15, I gave up hope and put the handset back in the cradle. I had no idea if he was actually home and too clever to answer the phone, or if he'd gone into hiding, as any sensible fugitive would do. I didn't even know if the number was still his. I was going to have to drive over to his place and check it out. I left the disorder where it was and locked the office door behind me. Before I got in the Mustang, I went around and opened the trunk and took the H&K out of my briefcase. I didn't have a concealed carry permit, but I wasn't going to leave myself unprotected. There was a fellow waxing his car in the driveway between my bungalow and the one next door. I wasn't aware a new tenant had moved in, but what did I know? He'd set a bucket and some rags to one side, and he was applying paste wax to the front fenders and hood of a black Jeep. A hose lay on the sidewalk, snaking out from between the buildings. He paid no attention to me, but I was careful, nonetheless, to slide the gun into my shoulder bag before I stepped into view. I got into the car and tucked the gun under the front seat before I turned the key in the ignition and pulled away from the curb. My run-in with Len played in my head like an endless loop of film. I lived those moments over and over, but regardless of how many times I reviewed the encounter, it ended the same way. Self-preservation being what it is, I wouldn't have handled myself any differently, but I wondered if there were options that hadn't occurred to me. My neck still felt like it was caught in a noose. I kept putting a hand against my throat as though to assure myself of my ability to breathe. I cut over to Chapel and took a right, driving me 8 blocks to Paseo Street, where Pinky and Dodie lived. I didn't think I'd been followed, because why would Len bother? He knew where Pinky lived. Or if he didn't, it would be a simple matter to pull up the data on his computer. I wondered if he had me in his sights, playing out enough rope to see if I'd make a beeline for Pinky. But if Len had known where he was, he wouldn't have had to jump me for the whereabouts of the manila envelope. I checked my rearview mirror, but there was no sign of an approaching car or idlers on the street. Gamely, I parked, got out of my car, and crossed the street. The front windows in both halves of the duplex were dark. I had no idea which was theirs, but I would soon find out. It was 1:50, sunshine, temperatures in the mid-70s, the scent of honeysuckle in the air. The breeze was playful, making it hard to believe there was anything going on that wasn't purely recreational in nature. But here I was looking for a goofball who thought he was smart enough to pull a fast one on a bad cop. This was probably the same skewed reasoning that got him thrown back in prison every time he got out. It was just my bad luck. I liked the guy. But that might have been what Len was counting on when he cut me loose. The name above the doorbell on the left was Ford, and on the right, McWhirter. I rang the Ford's bell and waited. If I were Dodie or Pinky, I wouldn't open the door to anyone. I turned and scanned the street first in one direction and then the other. I didn't see anyone sitting in a parked car, no one slipping furtively through the bushes. I leaned my head close to the door and knocked. Dodie, are you in there? It's Kinsey, a friend of Pinky's. I waited. Finally, I heard a muffled, "Show me." I recognized Dodie's voice. So I moved over to the living room window that was blocked by drawn drapes. Dodie made a small opening between the panels and stared out at me. A moment later, I heard her turn the deadbolt and slide the chain back on its track. She opened the door a crack, and I sidled in. I stood to one side as she reversed the locking process. If Len Priddy decided to come after her, all the locks in the world wouldn't do any good. He'd bash in the front window, and that would be the end of that. I didn't mention the likelihood, thinking there was no point in scaring her when she was already scared to death. In the living room to my right, the television set was on with the sound turned down. She put a finger to her lips and then gestured toward the back of the house. We tiptoed down the hall and into the kitchen, during which time I had the opportunity to register the changes in her. She'd been transformed by the weight loss. Pinky had told me she'd dropped 60 pounds, and the difference was amazing. Her bright blue eyes had always been her best feature. Now she had a better color on her hair, a better cut, and better makeup as a result of her new occupation. She'd also improved her wardrobe. The outfit she wore, long-sleeve V-neck sweater, well-tailored slacks, and expensive high heels, gave her the elongated look of a fashion model. Though Pinky was right about her tush. When we reached the kitchen, I whispered, "You look great." "Thanks," she whispered back. "Why are we whispering?" She held up a finger and wagged it, like I wasn't supposed to ask. She grabbed a pen and a copy of the newspaper and wrote a note in the margin that said, "Bugged." Under her breath, she said, "You must be looking for Pinky. What's he done now?" "He's pissed off a cop named Len Priddy, which is not a good idea." "Oh, him," she murmured. "He stopped by a while ago, and I said Pinky'd gone to see you." I closed my eyes, suppressing a shriek. No wonder Len had showed up. He'd already spied on Pinky at my office that morning, and now she'd steered him right back. "What's the matter?" she asked. "Don't worry about it," I said. "You know anything about the photographs he stole?" She blinked. "Photographs?" I waited, hoping she'd cough up what she knew. "Dodie, you've got to trust me. So far, I'm operating in the dark. I can't help him unless I know what's going on. Promise you won't tell." I wanted to roll my eyes. Instead, I crossed my heart with my index finger, swearing fealty for life. She put a hand across her mouth to shield what she said, lest someone looking on from a distance might be skilled in reading lips. As we were indoors, I didn't see the necessity. I was forced to lean close to hear her since she was already whispering.
"There were pictures of me, mugshots from that time I was picked up for soliciting. Also, the mugshots and police reports from the drunk and disorderly arrest. That cop knows I work for Glorious Womanhood, and if my regional manager finds out I've been in jail, I'll lose my job. She's already pissed off that I'm beating her sales."
"Len's blackmailing you?"
"Not exactly. He's using the photographs to keep Pinky in line, making sure he reports all the talk on the street."
"Pinky's a confidential informant?"
"I suppose. Anyway, he's destroyed all the stuff on me, so he says Len can go screw himself."
"Unless Len uses his computer to call up your criminal history and print it out again."
"Oh."
"That aside, I still don't get it. From what Pinky told me, there was a second set of photographs he thought he could use to get himself out of trouble. You know the story there?"
"I do, but he doesn't know I know, so you have to promise you won't ever let on."
"I'm already under oath here," I said. She wagged a finger at me again and then opened the back door and pulled me out onto the porch.
"He borrowed money from a loan shark named Lorenzo Dante, and payments come due."
"How much?"
Her paranoia was contagious, and I couldn't bring myself to use a normal tone of voice.
$2,000. He's been trying to get the money together, but no luck. He sold his car and pawned the Rolex that came into his possession from an unnamed source. He also hawked my engagement ring, but then got cold feet.
I thought back to our first meeting, remembering the band of white on his wrist where he'd once worn his watch. It dawned on me then his car hadn't been in the repair shop at all. By the time he came to me for help, he'd already sold it. She looked at me anxiously.
I don't suppose you could lend him the money. He'd pay you back.
She paused and then, in the interest of full disclosure, added,
Eventually.
She had the good grace to blush. I was offended she'd tried dinging me for the bucks, but it's tough to convey outrage when you're whispering.
He already owes me $225, which is how he got your engagement ring out of Hawk.
She squinted at me in disbelief.
He took $200 for a ring worth $3,000?
Let's not worry about that now. What makes the second set of pictures so valuable?
I'm not sure. I do know that cop wants to get his hands on them.
Tell me about it, I said dryly. Where's Pinky now?
He said it was better if I didn't know. He said if you came around looking for him, you'd figure it out.
Oh, great. Did he say anything else?
Not a word.
I thought about it briefly, but couldn't think how else to quiz her on the subject of Pinky's whereabouts.
I think it'd be smart if you laid low yourself. You have a place you can go?
She fixed her big blue eyes on me. I thought she'd seriously overdone the mascara until I realized her lashes were false.
I'm completely on my own.
Oh, come on. There must be some place. She reduced her whisper to a point that only animals could hear. I leaned close.
What about your apartment?
She said.
No one would think to look for me there.
I said, Ah, well, that's a tricky proposition. Len's already pissed off. He threatened to kill me less than an hour ago. I'm risking life and limb just talking to you. I put you up at my place, no telling what he'd do. You must have family or friends. She shook her head.
Pinky's all I got. Anything happened to him, I don't know what I'd do.
I'm sure he'll be fine.
What about me? What am I supposed to do?
Just don't open the door. Someone knocks hard. Call 911.
I'd rather come to your place. We wouldn't be a bother.
We?
Me and Cutie Pie, the cat. I can't leave him here all by himself.
I looked around, but there was no sign of the beast. What was with these people? She was just like Pinky, trying to maneuver me into doing her a favor that would put me in the soup. Having said no once, however, I found this round easier. Sorry, but it's out of the question. I'd be happy to drop you at a motel.
Oh, no, hon. Motel won't take a cat like him. For one thing, he sprays. And if he gets mad, which he does about half the time, he pees in the middle of the bed. So I guess I'm stuck.
You'll think of something, I said, having no idea what. As she walked me down the hall to the front of the house, she pointed at the television set in the living room. She did a charade of listening devices and a transmitter and a receiver. Or at least, I think that's what it amounted to. I nodded, and when we reached the door, she said,
Well, it was nice of you to stop by. If I ever hear from Pinky again, I'll let you know.
Her tone, while ostensibly normal, had a sing-song quality that wouldn't have fooled anyone with an ear to the wall. Thanks, and good luck, I said. Whispering again, she said,
You sure we can't stay with you?
Did I mention my allergies? Put me in a room with a cat and I blow up like a puffer fish. I had to be hospitalized just last month.
Too bad, she said. I could have done you a makeover. You could really use the help.
Once back in my car, I cut over three blocks and turned right onto State Street, then pulled into a small parking lot where an Asian food market and an acupuncturist had set up shop side by side. I found an empty slot and sat there thinking about Pinky and where he might be. From what Dodie said, he was confident I'd figure it out, Which meant what?
The only haunt of Pinky's I knew about was the Santa Teresa Jewelry and Loan.
Oh.
I fired up the Mustang and drove into town. I reached Lower State and cruised past the pawn shop, and when I turned at the corner, I saw Len Pretty's dark green Chevrolet parked at the curb. Clearly, June had company, and I'd have to postpone our conversation. I kept on going, a shiver of cold running up my spine. I returned to the office, thinking I'd call her after a decent interval had passed. In the meantime, I'd use the time to tidy up. I picked up folder after folder, reuniting them with their contents and returning them to the drawers. After 15 minutes, I took a break. I'd never had my morning coffee. I'd offered Pinky a cup, but he declined, citing the hurry he was in. After that, I'd been distracted by Earl Dean's visit, lunch with Cheney, and my surprise visit from Len. I went down the hall to my kitchenette, picked up the coffee pot, and turned on the water. There was a hissing, pop, and spurt that made me jump half out of my skin, but no water. What the heck was that about? I remembered then that the water department had notified me of the 8-hour shutoff. I'd forgotten that I'd intended to work from home and nearly wept when I thought of all the trouble I could have avoided if I hadn't come in. I abandoned the idea of coffee and went back to my desk. I looked at my watch. It had been a good 30 minutes since I'd driven past the pawn shop. Surely Len was gone. I hauled the phone book from the bottom drawer. Once I found the listing for the pawn shop, I made a note and dialed the first 3 digits. I don't know what stayed my hand, only that I hesitated. This is how I experience the aha moment on the occasions when they occur. In the back of my mind, I carry the imprint of Dodie's whispering because she believed her place was bugged. I had apparently juxtaposed that worry with a recollection of the fellow waxing his car in the driveway that runs between my bungalow and the one next door. It seemed curious at the time, but not alarming. What lingered was the image of the hose. As far as I knew, no one had moved in. So, who was the guy? More important, how had he managed to wash and wax his car with the water turned off? I got up and peered out the window. He was long gone, and I didn't see any unfamiliar cars parked on the block. I took the penlight from my shoulder bag, and instead of using the front door, I let myself out the back and moved between the two bungalows. I wasn't sure what I was looking for. While there was still ample daylight, the space was in shadow. I scanned the roofline for wires. I shone a light into the crawl space under the building. I reached the faucet where the hose had been neatly recoiled. Above the spigot was the window that looked into one end of my kitchenette. I looked down. In the wall, there was an aluminum mount with something affixed to it by means of a wing nut. I hunkered and let the light play over the device. The pickup unit was a vibration-sensing contact mic of the sort I'd seen at the local electronics store. A hole had been drilled through the siding and the mic installed between the studs. The amplifier, transmitter, and recorder were concealed in a wall-mounted box that looked like something a utility company would insist on your using and then charge extra for. This type of surveillance equipment was limited, but it was cheap and easy to acquire. I didn't think Len was concerned about the legalities. Whatever intelligence he gathered wouldn't be used in a court of law. It was intended for his ears only. I returned to the office and crawled along the baseboard on my hands and knees. The technician, doubtless a cop in Len's personal posse, had miscalculated the depth of the wall, and I could see a tiny point in the drywall where the probe had come close to breaking through. My first impulse was to go back and rip out the wires, or at the very least, find a way to short the connection. I considered my options and decided it was better to leave it where it was, so that Len would imagine he had access to my private conversations. I gave myself the rest of the day off. I couldn't work in circumstances where everything I said might be monitored. This meant phone conversations would be impossible, and any walk-in clients, few and far between as they were, would have to be removed to a separate location to discuss their business. This would not make a good impression. With the water off, I couldn't flush the toilet or wash my hands. Aside from that, I still felt like crap, and since I wasn't being paid for the pain and suffering, I decided to bag it. Once home, I searched my apartment for bugs, and when fully convinced the place was clean, I went to Rosie's, where I drank bad wine and ate a Hungarian dish I couldn't pronounce. This was getting on my nerves, and I wondered if I'd have to find another place to hang out. Nah, probably not. By morning, I felt restored. I took Len's threat seriously enough that I decided to avoid the topic of Audrey Vance from that point forward. I should probably have been ashamed of my cowardice, but I was not. I resolved to mind my own business, as Cheney Phillips had cautioned me. This determination lasted the whole of the drive to the office. I wasn't sure what to do about the bug in my wall, but I knew I'd figure it out. I parked in a generous spot and patted myself on the back for my good fortune. I was on my way up the front steps when a car came around the corner and pulled into the spot behind mine. Diana Alvarez got out. At the sight of her, I jumped as though I'd touched a live electrical wire. I thought about fleeing, but she'd wedged her nifty white Corvette into the space behind my Mustang, parking so close to my rear fender that I couldn't have pulled away from the curb without inching forward and back, shifting from drive to reverse 15 times, which would have been humiliating for someone bent on escape. I was also inhibited by the fact that she had a young woman with her. Perhaps not content to aggravate the life out of me herself, she'd brought along a cub reporter for training purposes. Diana wore an adorable dark brown A-line skirt and matching vest that looked great with her blunt-cut brown hair and tortoiseshell glasses. I was dying to ask where she got the outfit, but I didn't want to get into any girlish exchanges, lest she imagine I liked her. She held her left hand in an upright position, much as a dog owner would in signaling stay. I checked her right hand to see if I'd get a doggy treat for my obedience. "I know you don't want to talk to me, but hear me out. It's important," she said. I didn't trust myself to speak, so I shut my mouth. "This is Melissa Mendenhall. She read the article about Audrey and has information that casts her death in a whole new light." All I could think about was the spike mic sticking out of the exterior wall of my bungalow not 20 feet away. I knew it was geared to pick up conversations within the office walls, but at the mere mention of Audrey's name, I could feel a damp spot form across my lower back. Len had warned me Audrey was off limits unless I wanted my life shortened by some years. While I didn't take the threat that seriously, I'd developed an appreciation for the man's ability to inflict pain. I said, "This isn't any of my business. Marvin fired me." "I talked to him about that, and he's beginning to repent," she said. "I promise you'll want to hear what she has to say." I gave this 4 seconds worth of consideration and then said, "Not here. If you want to have a conversation, let's get off the street." She said, "Fine." There was no way the three of us could squeeze into the Corvette unless Melissa sat on my lap. My 2-door coupe wasn't much roomier, but at least I'd be in the driver's seat in the literal sense of the word. I unlocked the Mustang and we sorted ourselves out, me getting under the wheel and Diana hunched over, edging awkwardly around the passenger side seat and into the rear, which was barely big enough for grocery bags. Melissa was a tiny slip of a thing, small dark eyes, wispy dark hair, and what they used to call a pixie cut. Kids nowadays wouldn't know the term, but the effect was the same, short and brushed forward around her face. She should have consulted Diana about her wardrobe. Even I would have done better than the oversized T-shirt and jeans that were inches too short. I turned to the two of them. "So, what's up?" "I'll go first," Diana said with a quick look at Melissa. "Sure." "Melissa contacted me at the paper.
She hadn't heard about Audrey's dive off the bridge until she read the article last Thursday. The minute she saw it, she went to the police, because her boyfriend died exactly the same way 2 years ago. She thought they'd want to pursue the connection, so she gave them all the relevant information. She hasn't heard from them since. I said, "That's not unusual. An inquiry like that takes time." The guy stonewalled her right there. She thought he'd follow up, but he won't return her calls. Who'd she talk to?
That's just it.
Sergeant Pretty, Melissa said. The fuckhead. He was horrible. He treated me like shit. She looked too dainty and feminine to use such foul language. This, of course, elevated her in my opinion, and I hoped she was just warming up. People are all the time wanking on me about my potty mouth, so I like being able to point out someone worse. Tell her what you told me, Diana said to her. Our proximity discouraged conversation face to face. Melissa had delivered her remarks to my front windshield, and Diana was leaning forward avidly, with her head between us like a dog eager for a Sunday drive. This was the second time I'd referred to dogs and Diana in the same breath, and I apologized silently to mutts everywhere. My boyfriend committed suicide 2 years ago, or so I thought. I was devastated. I had no idea anything was wrong, so I couldn't come to grips with what he'd done. I knew Philip had gambling debts, but he was basically an optimist and talked like he was getting his shit together. Next thing I knew, he jumped off the side of a parking garage.
Binion's in Vegas, 6th floor, Diana said, always one for the telling detail.
Melissa went on. What struck me about Diana's article was the business about the woman's high heels and handbag side by side on the front seat of her car and the absence of a note. Philip's wallet and his shoes were arranged just like that in his Porsche, and he didn't leave a note either.
Diana said, now she's convinced he didn't kill himself, and here we are with Marvin, who feels the same way.
I thought the analogy was thin, but I wanted to hear the rest of it. The police in Vegas must have investigated your boyfriend's death.
They blew me off, Melissa said. All I wanted was someone to look into it and tell me if he did it on purpose or not. I didn't really believe it, but I figured that was just me in denial, like maybe he was in over his head and this was his only way out.
Diana said. She got her tires slashed.
I was getting to that, Melissa said sharply.
Sorry.
Philip had been to Vegas 3 times in 3 weeks and lost a bundle playing poker, or so the detective said. It still didn't sit right because his parents are loaded, and they'd have come to his rescue if he was in that much trouble. I explained all this, and the cops shut me down. I wasn't happy about it, but I knew they heard stories like this all the time, and I didn't expect special treatment. Then the vandalism started. I got my tire slashed, my apartment broken into, and all my ski gear stolen.
You needed ski gear in Vegas? I asked.
No, I was working in Vail, which is where I went after college, just for something to do. Philip used to come up and visit every couple of months. We both loved to ski, and it was easy to work all year long because it's so beautiful up there. A lot of people come in the summer as well.
Can I say something? Diana asked.
I pointed at Diana as though calling on her.
She said, a friend of hers, this was someone who worked at one of the Vegas casinos, told Melissa she must have stepped on some toes, because she had the same thing happen to her when she complained about this goon who roughed her up one time. Guy's name was Cappy Dante. He just got out of prison on a conviction for assault. His family lives here in town. His older brother's a loan shark. You might have heard of him, Lorenzo Dante. This is junior, not senior, though I understand the dad was just as bad in his day.
Dodie had mentioned Lorenzo Dante, the loan shark from whom Pinky had borrowed $2,000. I know the name, but I've never met the man.
Melissa found out Philip borrowed $10,000 from him, and that's what he lost at poker shortly before he died.
Or was killed, Melissa corrected. Are you telling me this loan shark's reach
stretched from Vegas to Vail?
Look, all I know is what happened when I made a stink. I'd heard Dante's name, and I thought the Vegas police should be told. Then the problem started, and I took my cue. I packed up my stuff and came back to Santa Teresa because my parents are here, and I really felt I needed to hang out someplace safe. Now I'm living with them and working as a nanny, so my name doesn't appear in public records like telephone and utility hookups.
And you explained this to Sergeant Priddy?
Every word of it. I told him Audrey's suicide and Phillips were identical, and I thought they should contact the Las Vegas police about reopening the case to see if there was a link to Lorenzo Dante here.
Police don't always appreciate being told their business, I remarked.
Diana said, Now she's scared. She thinks she saw Sergeant Priddy drive past her parents' house, like he wants her to know he knows where she lives. The car was dark green, but I couldn't tell you what kind.
So, what do you think? Diana asked, in a rare concession that I might have something to contribute.
I don't know what to think, but here's my take on it. You made a mistake going to the Santa Teresa police. Len Priddy works vice, and he's handling the shoplifting angle of Audrey's case. The Santa Teresa County Sheriff's homicide detectives are the ones in charge of the death investigation. You should drive out to Colgate and tell them.
You think they'll take her seriously?
Well, I know for sure they won't drive past her house, scaring her out of her wits.
Chapter 26. Nora. Dante had given her a key to the beach house. In her mind's eye, she was already there, waiting for him to appear. In reality, Channing had postponed his return to L.A. until Tuesday morning, which nearly drove her insane. She'd managed to get in a quick call to Dante's private line, where she left a message indicating she couldn't see him that day. Monday went on forever. So dull and flat, she wondered how she'd endured before Dante came along. Tuesday morning, she and Channing ate breakfast together, their conversation pleasant and inconsequential. The entire time she thought about Dante. It was almost as though he were sitting at the table with them, and she wondered if Thelma was present as well. She pondered the complexities of the human heart, cunning, opaque, unknowable, and impervious to judgment. What one did in the world at large might be condemned, but thoughts and feelings and daydreams were protected by the simple expedient of silence. How easy it was to deceive Channing, whose inner state was as unavailable to her as hers was to him. How many times had they sat at this same table, conducting the ordinary business of life? Courtesy served as an artful disguise that veiled the more profound dialogue of fantasy and desire. Toast, coffee, talk of her appointment in Santa Monica later in the day. She told Channing she'd set up a meeting with her broker to review her portfolio. He urged her to stop by the office, and she demurred, citing a round of errands. The exchange was perfunctory. She'd never understood Channing so well or liked him so little, but at least her infidelity had evened the score. Maybe one day she'd tell him. She hadn't decided yet. She walked with him to the door, and they kissed briefly. She took care to give no indication of her impatience to have him gone, or the giddiness she felt at what was to come. The minute he was out of the house, she put on her sweats and walking shoes and drove to the house on Paloma Lane. She left her car in the motor court at the beach house and tramped through the soft sand to the hard pack. She did her 4 miles on the beach, timing herself since she had no way to measure distances. Beach access was blocked in places, which forced her into detours that took her up a set of steep wooden stairs built into the hillside and through 2 gated communities, otherwise closed to the public. She emerged onto the 2-lane road that passed in front of the Edgewater Hotel, pausing to allow 2 cars to pass. The first turned into the driveway leading to the hotel entrance. The second came to a stop.
She heard a horn toot and looked over as the driver rolled down her window. "I thought I recognized you," the woman said, with what passed for gaiety. "What are you doing in this neck of the woods?" Imelda Malcolm lived two doors away from the Vogelsang's Montebello house. She was in her early 60s and bird thin, with sparse hair dyed a tawny shade. She pushed her sunglasses up on her head, and her washed-out gray eyes were sharp. Imelda walked the neighborhood streets, and Nora had learned to avoid the woman by varying her time and route so their paths wouldn't cross. Imelda was a vicious gossip, unapologetic about her rumor-mongering. Nora had joined her a few times, just after they moved to town, and noted that even in the open air, Imelda's comments were made under her breath, as though the intimacies she passed along weren't meant to be overheard. It gave Nora the uncomfortable sense that she was supporting Imelda's malevolence. "I like the occasional change of scene," Nora said. "How about you?" Imelda made a face. "I told Polly I'd sport her to a facial. You know, Rex filed for Chapter 13, or maybe it was Chapter 7. I forget which." "Talk about a low blow." "I heard. That's too bad." "Horrible," Imelda said. "Polly says she can't bear to walk into the club, and not just because they're so far in arrears. I'm sure Mitchell will find a way to let them know they're not welcome anymore, though he has too much class to make a scene. She says the women aren't actually cutting her, but the pity is more than she can stand. Have you seen her lately?" "Not since New Year's." "Oh, my God. She looks awful." "Don't tell anyone I said so, but I promise you she's aged 15 years. And she didn't look that good to begin with, if you'll pardon the observation." "I'm sure they'll weather the storm," Nora said. She glanced at her watch, and Imelda picked up on the hint. "I won't keep you," she said. "I'm glad I ran into you. I was going to call you about bridge tomorrow afternoon. Mitty's doing pre-op appointments for the work she's having done. And I thought, with Channing gone, you'd have time on your hands." "Won't work," Nora said promptly. "I have to be in L.A. I'm just waiting for a call back from our accountant to set a time. Besides, I haven't played for months. I'd make a miserable partner for anyone."
"Don't be silly. This is four tables, lunch and lots of wine, so no one takes it seriously. We're playing again on Friday, so I'll put your name down."
"I'll have to check my calendar and get back to you."
"My house, 11:30. We're usually done by 3.
She did a little finger wave, rolled up her window, and glided away. Nora closed her eyes, so irritated with the woman she could hardly move. She loathed presumption. She loathed the sort of female aggression Imelda wielded as a matter of course. As soon as she reached the beach house, she'd call and leave a message on Imelda's answering machine, saying she'd forgotten the prior engagement.
"So sorry, kiss, kiss. Maybe another time."
Imelda would know she was lying, but what could she do? Nora continued to the seawall and picked her way down the battered concrete stairs that put her back on the beach. If Imelda ever got wind of Nora's relationship with Dante, she'd have a field day. In truth, she was embarrassed she'd slept with the man. What was the matter with her that she succumbed so easily? She knew there was anger at Channing buried in the act. What distressed her was the truth about herself embedded in her decision. Apparently, she didn't require longevity or trust or the sanctity of marriage. All she needed was the opportunity. And there she was, flinging off her clothes in a white-hot flash of desire. Granted, Dante was spectacular, giving and tireless and loving and complimentary, the latter being another source of dismay. Remembering certain things he'd said to her, she felt easily gulled, a woman so shallow that the slightest praise had her flat on her back with her legs in the air. Had Thelma surrendered as easily? Good wine, a few superficial strokes, and she'd hopped into the sack without regard to Channing's marital status. Now Nora had tossed aside loyalty and fidelity, and while she was ashamed of her behavior, she was also unrepentant. The recollection made